Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hi, everyone. Emily here. Just wanted to pop in and give a little bit of context before we get into the episode. Phoebe was actually able to meet in person with Aryan, which was really exciting. But I unfortunately was not able to make it out west to join her there. So I was on Zoom during this interview, and Phoebe was in person, which is why she's doing a lot more of the talking this time around, just because it's a lot easier and I was just sort of in their headphones. Another bit of context, not only are we going to be talking about the full first season of the Disney Plus Percy Jackson adaptation, but we are also going to be talking a bit about Heroes of Olympus and Chalice of the Gods, so there will be some spoilers coming up for those if you have not gotten a chance to read them yet, just letting you know, although we do not get into it until a little later in the episode. So you'll hear us start to sort of change gears after we ask him what his favorite book is in the Percy Jackson series. So we'll then ask about Heroes of Olympus. But it was so, so great to do this interview, and I hope you all enjoy it. I know we had the best time recording it.
Welcome to Monster Donut, a literary and historical deep dive into the Percy Jackson series and all of its following spin-offs. I'm Phoebe, a dramaturg and story consultant.
And I'm Aryan. No, you go first.
No, you know what? You're right, because you're also on camera and I'm definitely not.
No, you take it.
All right, I'm Emily, classic scholar-ish.
I'm Aryan Samadri. I play Grover on the new Percy Jackson show.
Hi, Aryan.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, thank you for being here.
Yeah.
Just so people listening know, because I'm sure there will be a little bit of awkwardness, Emily is on Zoom. Aryan and I are in a studio in Anaheim right now. Shout out to Love and Laughter Music Group for hosting us.
Yeah.
So, first of all, I feel like we should start by saying congratulations on season two.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Yeah.
That's especially you, because I feel like it's Grover's season.
It's a little bit, yeah. I'm mostly just excited to wear the wedding dress,
yes.
To be honest.
Yeah. Do you have an ideal style that you're going for?
I'm thinking ridiculously deep V-neck and very, like, bright red high heels.
Yes.
Is, like, my only two requests.
You know, you have to carry it through from, like, the bright red Converse and then the bright
exactly,
red high heels.
Exactly, yeah.
Are there any elements, other than the wedding dress, obviously, that you're looking forward to from Sea of Monsters, whether they're Grover-related or not?
I think that I'm just excited to see Clarice and Luke more. Dior and Charlie are incredible, and this is... It's kind of Grover season, but I feel like it's really Clarice's season. I feel like she really gets to shine, and so I'm excited for that. I'm also really I was thinking about this on the way over here. I'm really excited for the I don't know how to pronounce it, but like the Charybdis scene. Yeah, I hope that's just super chaotic, and I hope Walker is like drenched the entire time.
I feel like that's like Tunnel of Love Part 2, right? With all the jets that are probably gonna have to be going.
Exactly.
yeah. And there's also the, like, he gets like picked up by the Scylla at one point.
Oh, I want to see that so bad.
Oh yeah, that's... yeah.
Yeah.
That was my question, actually, was so are there any scenes that you know already you're probably gonna crash the shoot day of, even if you're not in
the chariot race is 100%. Oh my god, I want to see those really bad, especially the one at the end where everyone can fight without the big metallic birds. And I also really want to, I can't believe I missed this. I never got to meet Tim Sharp, Gabe's actor.
Yeah.
And I met him like once passing through in the studio, and I had to go to set, so like we couldn't really talk. But he's like the coolest guy ever, and he seems so chill. So I really want to meet whoever they cast for Tantalus, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
They should just keep bringing him back as like various.
I hope. Yeah. I hope Tim Sharp plays like every like sleazy guy in the show. Yeah, I really want to meet that actor because I feel like he's going to be so much fun.
You know, one thing that I am very curious about what the writer's room is going to do with it is the empathy link.
I've heard a little bit about what they're just like ideas about what they might do. I'm excited. I really want Walker to wear a wedding dress also.
Yeah.
So if they can find that, if they can sneak it in there, mm-hmm. any way, shape, or form, I'll be happy.
Through like visions, so. Empathy visions.
Through visions, yeah. probably won't, but that would be a great scene.
Yeah. I've always loved the empathy link as like a representation of their relationship, of Percy yeah. and Grover's relationship, because the idea of Grover being in such a desperate place that he creates this connection between them that could kill both of them.
Yeah, he drops that so casually, too.
yeah. and, like, the fact that it stays with them through the rest of the series, that there's this thing that connects them and that they can sort of feel each other's emotions mm-hmm. and feel what the other person is thinking is just fascinating. And yes. I feel like it comes up, you know, every once in a while in the books, and I'm like, that's huge, though.
yeah, it's very fitting for the bromance.
Mm-hmm. mm-hmm. Well, while we're talking about that relationship, I feel like the show has kind of complicated it a little bit, especially at the beginning, because we started out with, like in the first couple episodes, yeah. with Grover kind of betraying him at Yancey Academy. And it started off kind of rocky. Mm-hmm. So I'm curious, as a book fan, what was it like to step into that relationship and kind of build on it as someone who was like familiar with it from the books?
Yeah. I've always loved their relationship in the books. I think it's like they're such good friends, and especially in like Chalice of the Gods, with Percy's like visions to the future, like Grover's still there. Mm-hmm. I always thought that was really funny. But yeah, I honestly really like that change, that Grover like has no other options. He's kind of backed into a corner, and he's willing to like tarnish his own image just to save Percy. Because like, if he does stay there, now that he has Riptide and he's, like, you know, discovering his powers, it's just going to get worse and worse and worse if he's in one location in New York. So, yeah, that was a change that I really liked. And I also liked that they kind of had to rebuild their relationship on the fly, because mm-hmm. neither of them really had a lot of time to think about it. And it's still there when, like, that kind of tension is still there when Percy wakes up from the nursery. But then it kind of dissolves when they meet Dionysus and Percy, like, realizes, like, that this is real and, like, this is kind of, like, above him, you know? Mm-hmm. So that was a change that I really liked.
Yeah, I was a big fan. I also found it kind of also carrying through into even episode 3, though, because episode 3, and we have a little bit of that, like, you know, Percy has that one moment where he says he feels so alone and he realizes that Annabeth and Grover's relationship is something that he, you know, that has a whole history behind mm-hmm. it that he doesn't understand. And I guess I'm also curious when it comes to Annabeth and Grover, it's kind of the same question here. Are there elements of that dynamic that you've liked exploring through the show? Because we're not in Percy's perspective anymore. So
yeah,
like,
exactly.
We can actually explore that dynamic in a different way.
Mm-hmm. Again, like, reading the books, that's always something that, like, I love the fact that it was from Percy's perspective because, you know, like, the point of it is that you're being told a story. But, you know, you never really get to see, like, Grover and Annabeth's relationship because they've been through so much together. And even when Luke is saying, like, oh, I'm on Annabeth's side, like, all the time, that's just because of, like, the stuff that they've gone through together with Grover. And so, I'm really glad that we get to explore that a little bit in the show. Yeah, just the fact that it's outside Percy's perspective. I thought that was really cool.
Yeah, the moment I loved was, it was at the end of episode 3, when you kind of, like, put them in their place.
Yeah, yeah. Because, like, Grover's really familiar with both of their habits. It's like, do you remember in the books where Annabeth's, like, talking about Thalia, and she's like, I don't know if you guys, like, to Percy, and she's like, I don't know if you guys would be best friends or hate each other.
Yeah.
I feel like that's what Grover feels about Percy and Annabeth, you know?
Uh-huh.
Like, it's such a delicate, like, balance whether or not they're gonna become enemies for life or best friends. So I really like that he has to keep them in their place a little more, because I feel like in the books, like, he doesn't, I feel like in the show he does, like, have to keep them in check a little bit more than in the books.
Mm-hmm. You can feel that he's 24
You can definitely feel that he's like the oldest of the group.
Uh-huh. Were you channeling any 24-year-olds in your life? How did you approach playing a 24-year-old?
Any 24-year-olds in my life? It was weird. It was I'm going to say that I mean this in the best way possible. I was a little wary coming into this because Walker and Leo were so young. And I'm not saying I was like 17 when I like met them, but you know, it was just with like a 2 or 3 year age gap. I didn't know how much I was going to have to like babysit, you know, that's like such a bad word for it, but I didn't know like how like easily we would get along, but they are so like mature. They're like, I've never once felt that age gap when talking to them, and we're like, I'm very grateful to be, you know, good friends with them. So it felt weird having to like quote unquote parent them on set, like, you know, be the one to keep them in check when in real life they would never be bickering this much. Yeah, I don't know. I've mostly just channeling my mother, really.
Okay, you mentioned Thalia a little bit earlier. And I feel like that's a huge part of the Grover, Annabeth, Luke dynamic,
yeah.
That whole history there. And so I kind of want to talk about the Thalia of it all. I'm sure it'll come up a lot more in season two. It feels very relevant to season two. But it's also just sort of a core part of Grover's character. And so I'm curious how much, if at all, is Thalia playing into your performance as Grover?
That's actually a really good question. I think something that the show did, or something that the show tried to do a little more, because again, it's not from Percy's character, from Percy's point of view, sorry, is show that Grover is like his own kind of guy. He has his own quest. You see it when he goes to the council. You see it when he's, you know, in Medusa's basement, when he finds out about Ferdinand, with the addition of the Augustus stuff in the Lotus Casino, mm-hmm. too. He's kind of going on his own quest. And a lot of that is he's just trying to make up for... because he still blames himself very much. You know, everyone's saying, like, oh, it wasn't his fault. But I think it's very difficult for him to let that go. And so a big thing that I was trying to... with the help of my acting coach on set, Andrew. I love that guy. We were trying to figure out, like, how much of Thalia does he like see in Percy? Like, is he more stressed because he can't afford to slip up? Or like, because I think with Percy, he knew Percy before, like much longer than he knew Thalia when he went on that quest.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So this is a lot more like personal for him. And also his searcher's license is on the line with this quest.
Yeah.
He messed up like big time. And he didn't get his searcher's license. So there's just so much riding on this that I feel like that pressure is kind of always on him. So just trying to figure out how to balance that and not make him just like super somber was a big thing.
Yeah. Because, I mean, there's definitely a part of him that feels very tragic.
Yeah. Times.
Like, we were just talking with Joe Trace the other day. We had an interview with him and we were talking about the ways that, like, grief and loss... I think he actually said that Grover... What did he say? I think I wrote it down, actually. Yeah, he said that Grover was someone who's sort of used to losing people. And,
yeah.
Like, people disappearing. Because he has, like, the satyrs also. All of these satyrs that go on the searcher's quest, and they don't come back. And he's just... That's sort of a staple of life for Grover.
Oh, my... That's so sad. Yeah, I mean, that's a really good way to put it. I hadn't thought about it like that before, but yes, he is very accustomed to people, like, disappearing.
Yeah, it's part of why I loved the addition of Augustus into the show. And also the emphasis that we put on Uncle Ferdinand, because you could really feel, like, the way that these satyrs are kind of disappearing. And that they're, you know, they're out there. You think they're on this, like, grand quest, and then you find them, and it's not
some
at
of them
all...
Don't make it, like, bad in New York or...
Yeah.
Yeah.
I just want to jump in, too, because speaking of the Lotus Casino, a question that just occurred to me that I don't know if you can answer or not is, how much do you think Grover actually forgot over the course of his time in the Lotus Casino? And did he forget all the way through Thalia? Or do you think it was more, like, immediate events? Like, how much is he keeping with him during those scenes?
Oh, damn. That's something I should have thought about. That's... Very good question. It's weird because he remembers Pan. I think it's less so like forgetting, I think, that he did, and it's more so he was just like reduced to his base instincts of like find Pan, eat food, like protect. Like he does all of those very, like those are the only things he does when he, you know, comes out of the Lotus Casino. He doesn't know these people, but he just on a very instinctive level needs to protect them. You know, he like goes along with them and he's like, I don't know you, but yeah, I'm down to go on this quest. He takes the back seat in the car, which I thought was like a really funny detail. Cause that's something Grover would do, even if he's not like, you know, high on the Lotus Casino, whatever. I think just the entire thing was him like at a very fundamental level. He's so much more vulnerable. Cause I feel like he's a very empathetic character, but he also doesn't like give away too much. You know, he never tells Percy about Thalia, or like Annabeth is the one who reveals like the Cyclops thing. Like how they were like captured by the Cyclops and how they were tricked. And Grover never really like gives away too much, because I think the biggest thing about his character is that he shoulders all of that for Percy, for Annabeth. And he just like feels very deeply. And so I think in that scene, something that I really liked, the way that they wrote it, he was so much more open with Percy. Like immediately he's like, I was so close to finding Pan, and he never really talks about it to Percy and Annabeth.
Yeah,
he's
true.
Like he says to Augustus that he can't really talk to his friends about it, but you know, in that moment he just kind of lets that go, and he does kind of open up. I don't know, I thought that was really cool. I can't even remember the original question, I'm so sorry.
Oh, no, it's great. But there's that moment in the right before they get in the car where he's like, wait, are we late because of me? Where I just saw all of the stuff you were talking about, I feel like. And it was just a really great moment.
Mm-hmm. That was a lot of script and it like chicken scratch on my script for that. Like one line. It's like those single lines where it's like so much. Those are always like the toughest ones to get. That was definitely up there. Like even after we finished that, I never really thought I got it until I watched it back, and I was like, oh yeah, they helped me kind of get that moment.
Yeah, well, you did a great job. We could not stop talking about how amazing a job you did, and it is so well deserved. Like, truly incredible work.
Thank you very much.
I'm curious, because you're talking about like, you know, chicken scratch on your scripts and everything. We got a question from Patreon.
Ooh.
That I feel like this might be the time to bring it up. They asked, were there any moments while filming where the team took your input and adjusted a scene, or that?
That's such a cool, this is unrelated. I love fan questions so much. During like the 42 West panel, we got a bunch of fan questions. And after that, we went backstage, and this woman came out with like a huge stack of just fan questions, and I took them home, and they're all like so cool. They're all so like, I don't know, just stuff I've never heard before. But that's a really good question. There's a couple stuff. I think with Grover, a lot of the stuff about him is like physicality, and a lot of that was just like on the fly, like it's just like, oh, I didn't know he could do that. But during the Council of Cloven Elder scene, I think this was cut, but like after he walks in, he's like crazy awkward about it. And I like really wanted to lean into that. And so I was talking to my acting coach about it, and I was like, would it be too much? Like, would it be too much of a gag if he was like trying to figure out if he should bow or not? And he's like, yeah, you can throw that in there. And I did it, and I guess people thought it was funny, and they let me keep it. And during the Cerberus scene, when I'm crawling out of his mouth, that it's kind of like hard to choreograph that, you know, like you can't really, there's not a lot you can do it during rehearsal. And so they're like, yeah, just go for it. Do whatever you want. And I just like crawled out, and I kind of like kicked at him a little bit. And yeah, the entire thing, they were just like, they're so like open to anything, which is what I loved about working on the show. Like, they were just so open to input. And for that, they're just like, yeah, do whatever you want.
That's awesome. That was from Ethan and Nicole. Thank you, Ethan and Nicole.
Thank you, Ethan and Nicole.
Back to our earlier conversation, we briefly touched on empathy. Mm-hmm. And so I do want to bring up something that we talked with Daphne Olive about.
I love Daphne.
I love Daphne. We're big Daphne fans.
Yeah.
We asked her what she thought Grover's fatal flaw might be. Mm-hmm. And she said empathy. And I found that answer fascinating.
Yeah.
I'm curious if you have thought at all about Grover's fatal flaw.
Yeah, I think it's something that I thought a little bit about during the start. And then this is going to sound weird. I tried, like, not to think about it too much once I had had it, because I felt like I would have started to lean into it too much. I just wanted to be, like, again, like, that's what I love about, you know, doing an adaptation, is that you know where the story is going to go. You can set up so much. And the writers really leaned into that, which I love, with, like, Easter eggs and cameos and just setting up, like, little things. And so something I wanted to just try and incorporate into, like, that performance as, you know, subtly as I could, was just his fatal flaw, which 100% is empathy. He feels way too deeply. Mm-hmm. And I think that's why he's so, for lack of a better term, adverse to risk in the beginning. He's, like, super skittish, and he, like, doesn't really want to, like, put him and his friends in danger if he has to. I mean, no one wants to, but, like, he, like, really tries to rein in some of the more Percy tendencies. Uh-huh. And I think that's just because he feels really deeply. He knows what Percy is feeling all the time, and so he can tell if it's out of rage, out of defiance, spite, whatever. And I think that's also why he's, you know, other than the fact that he's, like, a nature spirit, why he's not super violent. It's because he's like, oh, I wouldn't want to be fought. And so I think if I was a monster, I would just want, like, whoever was fighting me to run away instead, you know? Mm-hmm. I think there's just so much about him that you can really see comes from his fatal flaw being empathy.
Yeah. Mm. I was especially excited about the way that Daphne talked about it, because she talked about fatal flaws being both your greatest strength and your greatest weakness.
Oh, yeah.
And that's totally, I saw that 100%, especially in your scene with Ares.
Yeah.
And just way that he is able to see straight through him. And I was like, that's pure empathy at work right there.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah, it's like, even like with Sally and with Ares, like with Sally, he's like burdened by this empathy, and he can't, you know, he can't show it because he has to be there for Percy, but he's like, because he knows from the start what Sally's trying to do. Like, the second she's like, she's the Minotaur is tracking the half-blood smell. That's what he's after. He knows, like, immediately what Sally's going to do, but he can't say anything about it because, like, it's not his place. And I think that's a lesson he learned the hard way, that he can't let himself get too attached. He can't fight for Sally to stay because, you know, it's just gonna, like, the harder he tries, like, the more he tries, he's just gonna, like, get caught up and, like, wound up, and his biggest fear is that he's gonna mess up and, like, lose the people that he cares about, which is 100% a huge weakness of his fatal flaw. But then, again, you have that scene with Ares, and he just sees right through him. He feels everything that Ares feels, and he exploits that. And it's just really cool. I loved how they showed it. It was awesome.
Yeah, that Ares scene was potentially my favorite scene in the season.
It was my favorite scene to film.
Yeah?
Yeah, Adam. Oh, my God. Adam is the coolest guy ever. He's incredible.
It was, I don't even know the words to put to it. It was just, I was fascinated by it. Any time that the show did something that was just completely not in the book,
yeah,
I was 100% for it. I was so excited, you know, leaning forward the whole time. Did you have any, like, favorite scenes or changes either to Grover's character or just to the story?
Yeah. There's a lot. I'm not going to say Ares because that feels like an easy answer, but my answer is Ares.
Yeah.
obviously, like, the Medusa stuff. I mean, you have Jessica Parker Kennedy. She's incredible. It's, like, a shame not to, you know, give her her spotlight. And I'm really glad that they did. They gave her time to, like, play with this character. And it makes sense that this is, like, way more personal for her. Mm-hmm. You know, with Percy being a son of Poseidon. And I think something I don't think I talk enough about is that final, something that I can finally talk about now that the show's out, is that final interaction between Luke and Percy. Because in the book, it's just like, oh, Scorpion, 60 seconds, Percy. But in this, it's like, I don't know, just like the fireworks, like reflecting in their eyes, and they're like Percy realizing it, and they have an actual fight, and Percy apologizing after he...
I know.
Oh, dude. I mean, both Walker and Charlie are incredible actors, and they just, they kill that scene.
They did.
Yeah. There's no other way to put it. That was, I don't think it would have worked if it was anybody else, and... Oh, I don't know. Everything about that scene is just incredible.
Yeah, I was in love with the change to, like, the fact that he's trying to recruit him now.
Yeah.
Instead of just, like, you know, sticking a scorpion on
him. Yeah. Oh, it was really cool.
Yeah. I think I've hit all of the show questions that I had, and then I was going to transition into book questions.
Yeah.
If you'd like to talk about the book.
I'd love to.
What was your relationship to Grover before being cast as him? Were you, like, a big Grover guy, or...
Oh, yeah, he was... He was 100% my favorite character.
Oh, really?
So much, yeah. So much so that, like, when I was a kid, because I read Percy Jackson, I convinced myself I, too, could also talk to animals. And I was, like, trying to convince my classmates in the fourth or fifth grade. And they're like, you know that's not true, right? And I was like, no, guys, watch this. And I ended up having my lunch stolen by a crow. So it didn't go great, but he was always my favorite character. I didn't know this until my mom told me this a little bit ago, but when I was a kid, I used to walk on my tiptoes the same way that Grover does.
Oh.
I don't know why. I guess it was like a habit that I developed at an early age, and they had to like force me to walk normal.
Yeah.
And it turned out being the same thing that Grover did, which was really cool.
Yeah, that's fate.
It's fate.
That's so funny because when I was convinced I was a daughter of Poseidon for a while. And I remember I was at a softball game once or softball practice. And I said, like my father is Poseidon. And everyone was like, shut up, Phoebe. And I was like, watch, I can make it rain. And it immediately started raining.
It was
wild. It was one of the craziest moments of my life.
Dude, like right after I read Avatar, I started watching, right after I read Percy, I started watching Avatar. That was not a good combination. I was so convinced I could not only talk to animals, but waterbend.
Yeah.
Neither of which, I don't know if you know this, are not true.
Mm, okay.
Yeah, so that was not a good combination.
But how do you know, though?
How, exactly.
You know, maybe one day.
I could still get accepted to Hogwarts.
You could.
Yeah. You just haven't learned how to channel it yet. That's
exactly.
The problem.
Right. Exactly.
Do you have a favorite of the original series?
Yeah. I think me and Walker talk, this is all we talk about. I think my favorite to film, the one that I'm most excited to film, will probably be 3, because there's new characters and it's in the winter and we're like, you know, it's just like so different to any of the other books. But to read, 5, easy, was my favorite. There's just so much that's cool about it, you know? That scene with, I've said this a million times, but the thing that I'm most looking forward to seeing adapted is that scene where Clarice kills the Drakon. I reread that recently because I was talking about it in a different interview, and she like ties it to the back of her chariot, and it's awesome. Because she has the blessing of Ares, so she's literally glowing red with rage.
Yeah,
it's badass. I can't wait to see Dior do that.
Yeah. And I think you mentioned on Seaweed Brain, the Seaweed Brain podcast, once upon a time, that you were reading The Song of Achilles.
I did, yeah. I was reading Song of Achilles. That book is so good. I read it. I read almost all of it in one, like, 5-hour sitting on a plane trip from the press tour, like, the last leg of the press tour coming back home. I was talking to Dior about this the other day. That relationship between Achilles and Patroclus is pretty much the exact same thing that happens between Clarice and Selena, right?
Uh-huh.
Yep.
It's just so cool.
Yeah, that whole book, I mean, it's full of, we talked about it, it's full of Iliad parallels.
Yeah.
And that's probably my favorite of all of them.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I forgot I forgot about that when we were doing the reread for the podcast. So I hit that point and I was like, wait a minute.
Yeah. It's literally the exact same thing. Patrocles stresses like Achilles, goes, tries to fight, dies. The other guy loses it.
Tragedy. We love it. Yes. Well, I think it's also pretty well documented that you're a Heroes of Olympus fan, too.
Yes, yeah.
So I'd love to spend some time talking about that series.
Yes, please.
First of all, I think I heard recently that Leo is your favorite of...
It's not even close, yeah.
Okay, yeah. Explain why. I would love to hear why he speaks to you.
He's, I'm rereading through Heroes of Olympus right now. I'm on House of Hades. Mm. And, like, I feel like he's such a well-developed character. Like, it's easy to kind of, you know, cast him aside a little bit. He's like, oh, funny comedic relief. But then after he comes back from meeting Calypso, and everyone's like, oh, he's always, like, looking off into the horizon. It's so cool. It's just, I love what Rick did with his character. I think he's by and far the most interesting and the most nuanced character, especially because, like, Frank's weakness is literally fire. And so they're always on ease, and the Hazel thing. And he manages to get fireproof, like, cloth for his, like, piece of wood. That's, I don't know, everything about him is just so well-developed. And so, like, every character in Heroes of Olympus, that's why I love it so much, is because, like, every character gets their time in the spotlight.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I was just looking back on, like, some of my old Leo notes recently.
Leo notes?
My Leo notes from when we were reading Heroes of Olympus. And I was reminded of how much I enjoyed the way that his arc, like, he sort of starts out, you know, he's already got his insecurities and everything, but it's almost like he gets worse over time. It's such a realistic arc for him to get worse before he gets better.
Yeah.
And the way that he starts to feel insecure around the rest of the seven, starts to feel more alone, starts isolating himself. It's just so much more of, like, I don't know, I was just very taken by, usually you see this kind of arc with, like, they start out full of insecurities and then they, you know, they grow out of them. Yeah. But with Leo, it's, you know, it's more complicated than that.
Yeah.
Because of course it is.
I also think, like, part of the reason I like Leo so much, my dad is literally Leo, like an adult Leo. I've heard verbatim from him, like, quotes that Leo has said. Like, whenever he's like, Leo's like, oh, machines are so much easier to deal with from humans. I've heard that from my dad, like, verbatim. I'm not even kidding. He's, like, always tinkering with stuff. He's, like, incredible at putting things together and taking things apart. Like, I don't know. It's just, it's weird. Like, I see, like, I've heard, like, lines from Leo come out of my dad's mouth when I was a kid. So, I don't know. He's a character that I very much relate to in that sense. And he's just, like, so funny. I love him. Yeah. I love Leo.
That's awesome. I could never tell you who my favorite member of the Seven is. It changes constantly. Like, I honestly don't know if I have one. Do you have one, Emily?
I really like Piper. I think she by the end of, like, you know, the series, she kind of becomes my favorite of the Seven.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I it's funny because I've got, like, the character I like to talk about the most is obviously Jason. Yeah. Everyone who listens to this podcast knows I talked nonstop about Jason. The character I relate to the most, probably Piper. Favorite character? Couldn't tell you.
who's your, you said it was, like, changing all the time. So who's your most, like, recent favorite?
Right now, it's Jason, just because we just spent, you know, all this time rereading the series, and I spent so much time talking and thinking about him nonstop that I, like, I don't know, he's in my head now.
Yeah.
I find his arc fascinating. But I mean, the characters who are, like, closest to my heart are definitely Frank and Hazel. Like, I love them very much.
Why is that, if you don't mind me asking?
Honestly, I love a softer character sometimes. Mm. And there's something about the Son of Neptune specifically that, like, their dynamic with Percy while he's, like, struggling with his whole memory loss and them just taking care of him is just so beautiful to me. I love the Son of Neptune. It might be my favorite of
The
Heroes of Olympus books. Yes, I'm full of controversial opinions.
Wow. Gonna be honest, I would not have agreed to come here if I knew that. No, that's so cool.
What is your favorite of the books?
My favorite book? Probably House of Hades or Son of Neptune. Yeah, you too?
Yeah. I was going to say my other answer to your favorite character is Feral Percy.
Feral Percy.
Percy
yeah.
in House of Hades.
Yeah. Dude, the stuff that he pulls in Tartarus, crazy. Uh-huh. The jump from the cliff into Nyx's palace. How the hell did he do that?
I know. I've been saying this for years.
Or like jumping across the river. He just so casual.
And Annabeth, our narrator, closes her eyes. I still have not forgiven her for that. I know what I want.
My theory is that he stops believing he's mortal at some point and just sort of forgets that he has limitations. And it's just like, we're just going to go.
Yeah.
This will work. It's fine.
I saw one theory because I Googled it after. I couldn't stop thinking about how he made that jump. And so I Googled it. And I saw one theory where it was like because they're jumping over a river and he like used the power of that river or whatever. Because he did control the fire river, right? And so I saw a theory where he kind of like harnessed that.
Yeah. But it's also, isn't it like the river of pain or something? It's one of the rivers. It sounds like a terrible experience to try.
It's the one where it's like all of the souls, you know?
And they're like blaming Annabeth for murder and stuff.
Yeah.
Isn't that what happens?
it's the misery. That's the Cocytus.
Yeah. It's super like easy read too. So honestly really casual encounter. So that's probably how he did it. Like,
yeah.
Light work.
Yeah.
I saw this thing on TikTok where it was, you know, that monologue where it's like, where he's talking to Misery and he's like narrating.
Yeah.
And he's like, I wanted his like emo Percy. I saw a voiceover of that monologue. Someone like did an AI thing on TikTok and it's in Walker's voice and it sounds perfect. It's so creepy, but it's awesome. I like if we ever get into Heroes of Olympus, I want to. It's just like, I don't know, like produce or like coming to set or just, you know, be a part of that show in any way, shape, or form. Because it's like such a natural development of the books.
Yeah, it's so, we'd need to get Grover in there somewhere. we'd need to figure it out.
Yeah.
I feel like by that point, though, like you could make Coach Head. I feel like people wouldn't mind. If you replace Coach Hedge with Grover.
I could never do that.
No,
oh, my God.
We'd need the two of them.
Yeah. I think Grover's, the thing that I really liked about the end of Percy Jackson and the Olympians into Heroes of Olympus is that Grover's arc is kind of done. Like, he did everything that he wants to. And, like, I saw a lot of stuff. I'm very active on, like, Percy Jackson subreddits and TikTok or whatever. And so I'm always seeing, like, oh, where's Grover in Heroes of Olympus? And a lot of the times it's like, a lot of the answers, which I honestly kind of agree with, is his arc is, like, it reached its natural conclusion. As much as I would love to be in Heroes of Olympus, I will admit, when I was a kid reading Heroes of Olympus, I was pissed that he wasn't part of the Seven. but, yeah, I don't know. Like, I don't know. He's the Lord of the Wild now, and he's kind of got his own stuff going on. But I do want to see him, like, interact with wind spirits. Because that's, like, they're always talking to wind spirits. I don't know what it is about Heroes of Olympus.
That's true.
But there's always just, like, something going on with wind spirits. And so I would love, if he was to be in the show, I think that would kind of be his area of expertise.
He does get that one scene. No, he gets two scenes, right? He's got the, in Percy's dream.
Mm.
And then he has the rah-rah one. The Reyna one.
What?
You know how, like, we find out her initials in that one scene?
Oh, yeah.
And he's like, your initials are rah-rah. Yeah.
And everyone's like, Grover, stop talking. Yeah.
You should read Trials of Apollo, too. He comes back.
I saw that he's like, isn't he like a protector to someone in that?
Maybe you should read it. Maybe you should.
Maybe you should read it.
he plays a very interesting role, is what I'll say.
Ooh, all right.
I'm a fan of what we get from Grover. In that series. Nothing more. That's all you get.
All right. Okay. Apollo is like one of my favorite gods, so I've been meaning to get to that. That's part of why I'm rereading through Heroes of Olympus.
I'm such a fan of Trials of Apollo.
Really?
It's like that's kind of my. You know, I'm always just begging people to reach out to follow. I'm always like, you can't stop at Heroes of Olympus, please.
I don't know if, is Chalice of the Gods because it, like, mentions stuff in Heroes of Olympus and obviously, like, in the original series. Does it mention anything from Trials of Apollo?
It mentions things that we learn in Trials of Apollo. So, like okay.
Oh, because he talks about a talking sword, right?
I think the talking sword is Magnus Chase.
Oh, okay. Does he meet Magnus? I'm sorry. I'm, like,
just asking for spoilers.
Yeah, basically. So, basically, so, like, what's the plot of Trials of Apollo?
So, the way it ends is...
Like, who dies?
Well, doesn't Trials of the Gods take place in between Heroes of Memphis?
Yeah. Oh, does it?
Trials of Apollo, yeah.
Okay, because I remember him saying something about, like, a talking sword that would not shut up in Chalice of the Gods. So I thought that was something from either Magnus Chase or Trials of Apollo.
Yeah. While we're talking about Chalice of the Gods, Emily came up with an interesting question.
There's a lot of backstory here. Mm. Basically, before Chalice of the Gods came out, we wanted to make predictions for what would be in the book. And so we actually ended up making a bingo card full of our predictions to see if anyone would get bingo.
Did anybody get bingo?
No.
Oh. No.
We're really bad at predicting things, it turns out.
As you'll find out in a second, because this was one of the predictions that, as it turns out, nothing like this happened. Mm-hmm. But we were talking through, like, oh, well, we know the chalice gives immortality to mortals if you drink it.
Uh-huh.
So do we think there's going to be a scene where maybe Percy, Annabeth, or Grover are tempted to drink from the chalice? And we were trying to think of all the different things they might be tempted by for why they would choose to drink and choose immortality or something, or have some benefit from it. So we were wondering if you had any takes on what you think, like, Grover or any of the other characters, like, what their temptation might be.
What I would be tempted by? I'm sorry, this is such a lame answer. I don't think Grover would be tempted at all.
We had the same response.
I'm sorry, that's such a, like, lame answer, but because the biggest thing is, like, satyrs, like they are reborn as, like, flowers or something, so I feel like it would almost disgust him to break that cycle, you know.
That's a good point. I think the only reason that we could come up with was, like, maybe he would feel like he could do more to complete Pan's, like, mission if he were immortal in some
way. That's a good point.
Like, kind of actually take his place as Lord of the Wild.
Yeah.
But I feel like that was just kind of like here's a reason. I don't know. But Grover was, like, bottom of our list for characters who were actually going to consider it.
I do see, that's actually a really good, I didn't think about that. I could see him considering it for, like, a brief second, like, oh, I don't know. Because I think, doesn't Percy have, like, a slight second before he talks himself out of it? Or am I remembering this completely wrong?
No, I...
I remember him, like, saying, like, giving himself reasons why he shouldn't and why he didn't accept immortality the first go around. But I don't... Because the biggest fear was, like, everyone else was scared that he was going to drink from the cup, which is why... Oh, my God, what's his name? The really handsome guy.
Oh.
He works at
Ganymede.
Ganymede, yeah. That's why he trusted Percy with this quest, is because he didn't take
around. I think I'm the reason that I feel like, oh, we've talked about that before, is because he considers it in one of the Kane Chronicles crossover short stories.
Seriously?
Yeah. It's the wildest short story.
I'm sorry. I haven't read Kane Chronicles. Walk me through this.
You should definitely read the short story. But essentially, there's this moment where, like, a god is, like, one of the... he's kind of a hybrid Egyptian-Greek god.
Whoa.
He's talking to Percy about how, like, he messed up, basically, by not taking immortality. And that there are all these things that he could have done as a god to try and fix things. And look at how the gods are functioning now. Nothing has gotten better. And
oh, he's telling Percy that Percy messed up.
He's telling Percy he messed up by turning it down at the end of the last Olympian. And Percy's like, maybe I did mess up. Like, and he, like, actually thinks about it. And this guy's like, I can make you a god. Like, we can reconsider this, actually. And then Percy works through it and eventually, obviously, does not do that.
Right.
So, like, we kind of did get that journey for him already in that random short story. You should read it.
Yeah.
It's the third of the Kane Chronicles short stories.
Is that in like, you know, the collection of short stories? Like, the Camp Half-Blood, like, secret handbook or that has the Sword of Hades in it, right?
It's not in that one. It's in, like, Demigods and Monsters. I might be lying. I'm pretty sure it's in a book called Demigods and Monsters.
Okay.
I'm going to Google this, actually, because I don't know.
It's not in the Demigod Files, though.
The Demigod, right. Because that's where they meet Bob.
Yeah.
That's the story about
I love
they
that
meet
story.
Bob.
Yeah. Have you read those short stories?
I read the one about Bob because I was reading through Heroes of Olympus. But that actually, I think I did read through a good chunk of it. Because it was always on like a desk in our schoolroom, on set, and it was, and I just like picked it up and flipped through the pages.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of that one. Might be my favorite of the short stories, but there's some good Grover ones, I think, also.
Oh, cool.
Just not in that book.
Okay.
That book has like a Clarice short story. Oh, what's the other one? Oh, the Beckendorf and Selena short story.
It has a... Oh, yeah. That's so... Okay, now I want to read it. That's cool. Oh, The Bronze Dragon?
Oh, yeah. Yes. It's the introduction of Festus.
Nice.
Is in that
short
story. Anyway, enough for recommending you things.
No, please.
Have you ever read just like a random book? That
yeah, it's completely like off track.
So these short stories, I think they were released as bonus chapters in the Heroes of Olympus books, but he's released them separately, I think, as a collection. That's just Demigods and Magicians.
Magicians, that's what it is. Okay.
Interesting. Oh, because Kane Chronicle, it's more like
They're magicians,
like magicians, right?
Yeah.
I remember... I was in my friend's house, and I remember they had a copy of The Red Pyramid. Mm-hmm. So instead of talking to either of these friends, I just, like, sat on the couch and read The Red Pyramid, like, all the way through.
And that's valid.
It was a good book, dude.
Emily did something very similar with the first time she read The Titan's Curse.
Seriously?
Didn't you do the same thing, reading, like, The Titan's Curse for the first time and then reading it six more times in the same train or the
what?
Same car ride?
Oh, huh? Well, yeah, I was going to say, I wasn't ignoring my friends, but this is my, I think this is how I really got into Percy Jackson, because I'd read the first two books, but I hadn't, like, gotten into it. Mm-hmm. And then my family used to drive to Chicago, we started in Connecticut, to Chicago every year over the summer, and it's a 14-hour drive. And I would always bring like a crate of books with me to entertain myself. And I remember I was at the beginning of the car ride. I was like, you know, like, what am I going to read? And I pulled out the Titan's Curse, which I hadn't read yet, and was like, oh, I'll read the next Percy Jackson book. So I read it, finished it, and was like, wow, I really want to keep reading Percy Jackson. I love being in this world. And at the time, that was the last book that was out.
Oh.
And I didn't have the other two, though. So I was like, oh, man. And so I just turned back to page one and read it again.
Six more times?
Yeah, and then I kept doing that because I was like, I want to stay in this world.
Kind of awesome, man. I did the same thing on with book two. I was on a plane ride with Walker and Leah, and we were sitting like separate because I was in like a single aisle, and Leah was like way in the back, so I had no one to talk to. And I brought like a worn down... like a spare copy I had of Sea of Monsters, because I was like, oh, you know, and this was before we got the confirmation for season two. This is like during the press tour.
Yeah.
So I was like, oh, yeah. I might as well get started on prep a little earlier, like reread the book, like annotate it, do whatever. And I took like a quick nap and then read Sea of Monsters three or four times on that same plane ride in like a 4-hour sitting, and just like, kept annotating it. It was awesome.
That book like the back of your hand now.
That book like the back of my hand.
They stand up. You can just keep going.
Yeah, like there's so much about it that you forget. Like when you read it as a kid, you like remember all the big plot points. And then I read it back and I was like, I had no idea that they like crashed on shore and like Clarice had to say, like I completely forgot about that. Mm-hmm. I forgot about, like, Monster Donut, too.
How dare you?
I know. I'm so sorry. Never again. I'll never make that mistake. Like, I remember that they fought the Hydra, but I didn't realize that I forgot everything surrounding that interaction.
Right. That they, like, win by shooting it with a cannonball.
Cannonball. That's badass. Yeah.
I even forgot that when we just read it and we were in the episode. I was like, and then they defeat the Hydra somehow? And Phoebe was like, Emily, Clarice comes in and shoots her.
Wild.
Crazy.
So to wrap us up, I'll ask one more question. It's a question we ask at the end of all of our episodes, essentially, whenever we finish a book or whenever we finish an episode, we would design what we would make, like, the camp bead look like.
Oh, cool.
And so I am wondering if, because the bead at the end of the summer for The Lightning Thief is very Percy-centric. So if we were to make it
Trident, right?
Yeah, if we were to make it Grover-centric, based on Grover's journey in this season, what would you put on it?
Oh, man. For The Lightning Thief?
Yeah.
My first thought was the red winged shoes, but that feels less like a Grover arc thing and just like a funny little thing that he interacts with. Can I do two, like a show-specific one and then a...
Yes.
Okay. So for the show, his searcher's license is the flower, and that's kind of his whole arc.
Yeah.
So I would give him the flower, or like I would make the bead a flower, and my... The panpipes aren't actually in the show for the first season. And I was talking about this to Daphne, and we, like, I'm not sure when they're going to include them.
Yeah.
But, like, we, like, our theory was always that, like, he gets them after, like, with his searcher's license.
Yeah.
Because I feel like it makes more sense for a satyr to, like... It's like, you know, and, sorry, I like just watched Avatar, which is why it's on my mind.
Right, yeah.
It's like the airbending tattoos, you know?
Mm-hmm.
It's like you would only get the panpipe after you proved yourself.
Mm.
And so, I think in the show, he'll get them like after he gets his searcher's license or, that like, that's my hope. Not that anything is confirmed for season two can say out loud, but yeah, so for the book, I would make it like panpipes, probably.
Yeah.
Because I feel like that's more representative. Like, in the book, that's his representation of his...
That's very searcher's license. Grover.
Yeah.
Mm. We were joking when we were, like, coming up with questions, and this one, you know, we were trying to think of, oh, how do we phrase the bead question for this interview?
Mm-hmm.
I said, maybe the VR headset.
Yeah.
Because I'm like... I thought way too long about what game he could possibly be playing in there.
From personal experience, it was a black screen.
Right. Okay.
So I'm pretty sure he was just hallucinating.
You know, it feels like it. It feels a little bit like it.
Yeah. I think, like, for those VR headsets, like, I think it might honestly just be, like, a like, it might just be the mist.
Yeah.
I think they're just hallucinating the entire time with those on.
That makes more sense than what I said, which was he's playing Minecraft. Yeah. I was like, it's the nature. He's exploring the wild in cube form.
Percy, you don't understand. I was so close. I just got my blaze rods, Percy. I just found an ender fortress. yeah, Minecraft is probably the closest thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I'm right. Confirmed.
Yeah, confirmed. That is canon.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much, Aryan.
Thank you, guys.
This was a great time.
Thank you. This is so much fun. Thank you.
Thank you all for listening to Monster Donut. Next time, we've got yet another very special episode coming your way. I hope you enjoy it. Keep your eyeballs peeled on your feeds. Also, if you join us on Patreon, we have been giving our patrons a little bit of a sneak peek onto what's coming up and who we may or may not be interviewing next. And also on there, if you become a patron and join, we will occasionally pop in and ask if y'all have any questions for the people we're talking to. So if you'd love to learn more about it before it's happening and even get to ask a question, you can find us in our link tree. That's at PJOPod on Instagram, TikTok, and Twitter. You can also find a link to our merch shop on Redbubble or just go to redbubble.com/monsterdonut. And speaking of our patrons as well, we would love to give a huge thank you to RK, Window Wells, Emily Ann Bonnie, Roman Consul, Latino Kaya, Patty VCK, Bethany from Public Worth, Sydney Fox, Joke, Reina Avila Ramirez Ariano, Charlie McNeil, Bronte Lebo, Chief in Plays, Robert Gamer, Kels, Kari, Leila Hussein, Mason Bowman, Casey Cassidy, Evelyn Zamudio, Kelsey Young, Vizicat, Nikki Feldbaum, and Abby Gray. Also, if you would love to support us non-monetarily, leaving a rating or review is always great. We love to hear feedback from y'all. Also, we are still eventually going to do a wrap-up episode for season one of the Percy Jackson TV series, in addition to our Trials of Apollo wrap-up. So you've still got time to send in your thoughts. We've got a few more things coming up. So, if you have any questions you'd love us to answer, talk through, or if you have any analysis of your own you'd like to share, you can contact us on any of our social media on Patreon, or you can email us at monsterdonutpodcast@gmail.com. Thank you all for listening. Bye.